Welcome. This is one in a series of a broadcast that's part of the Interpreter Foundation's roundtables. This is Old Testament Lesson 14 from the Gospel Doctrine lessons. Ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me. It covers Exodus chapters 15 through 20 and 32 through 34, which deals with the children of Israel after the Egyptians are destroyed by the sea, which has been parted coming back together, and then about the tablets on which the commandments are there. Joining me today are Ben McGuire and John Gee. My name's Martin Tanner. I'll be moderating. And we hope you enjoy this roundtable. John, let's turn the time over to you first. You had some thoughts about where this whole story fits into the Pentateuch.
Okay, so the story that we have is the introduction to the Ten Commandments, and it takes us from the deliverance after the Red Sea and through the giving of the Ten Commandments. And you know, we think about the Ten Commandments as these written on these tablets of stone. The term for those is they're called tablets of the covenant. And there was a particular form when you made these covenant tablets in Moses' day. And you would start with a preamble, and then you'd have this historical prologue. Then you'd have the actual content of the covenant, that needed to be kept. And then later you'd get deposing the agreement, witnesses, curses, blessings, and other facets. So in the Pentateuch, Genesis and the first half of Exodus up through 19 are the historical prologue. They tell where Israel came from, and what they're doing there, and then the Ten Commandments in chapter 20 start us into the stipulations. And the book of Numbers will have alternate back and forth between a little historical prologue and then laws that come from out of that story in the wilderness. But it's important to realize that we're in a shifting a position here in this reading selection from telling where all this came from to now what do we do about it, and what is our covenant with God. And so that we're right at a crux there in the text.
Great background. And from there, Ben, you were going to tell us a little bit about the background or an introduction to the story itself that we're dealing with tonight.
Yeah, our lesson in the manual, anyway, covers a couple of different areas. One is it covers this initial trip into the wilderness by the Israelites, and then we get the story of Moses having to raise his arms, right, to ensure the success of the Israelites in their battle. In terms of the scriptural material it's covered, I like to think of this section as all about object lessons. We have these very very plain object lessons. Sometimes the Israelites seem to do better at accepting and understanding them, and sometimes they don't. When the Israelites leave Egypt, of course, they're planning on making this trip into the wilderness to have their feasts for the Lord. I think initially the plan, at least that everybody was being told, was is that they were going to go out and have their religious observances and head back. The desert in this part of the world is a pretty forbidding place, especially for a large group of people with women and children and men and animals and all their worldly possessions. To some extent, the Egyptians hadn't been all that worried about the Israelites leaving in this direction. They were worried more about the Israelites staying and trying to take over, because you didn't survive going through the wilderness. As Israel heads into the wilderness, we're going to see that they start encountering difficulties that we naturally expect. And they're going to be complaining about this, in particular to Moses, who's led them out of Egypt, right? what are they going to eat? Where's the water going to show up at? And as we see in the text, these are really very legitimate issues and concerns. If we don't find a way to deal with them, the Israelites will all die in the wilderness. So a couple things that I wanted to point out, and we're going to start here in Exodus 15. And we've just seen the sea devour the Israelites. It says that Moses brought Israel, this is in verse 22, Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Now, this is the three-day period, the three-day trip that they need to take from Egypt that they talk about when Moses is negotiating with Pharaoh. And it's, in some ways, this is kind of a symbolic distance also, right? They have to move outside of the cultic boundary of Egypt so that they can covenant with God. It's the same kind of idea when we have Lehi traveling 3 days in the wilderness and then setting up an altar and worshiping. And it says they came to Marah. They could not drink of the waters, that they were bitter. This is in verse 23. And then the people murmur against Moses. So in verse 24, the people murmured against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And he cried unto the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, which when he had cast into the waters were made sweet. There he made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he proved them. And so one of the things I think as we read through this reading material is that we start to see these different conditions, these different struggles, as faith-building exercises. Israel has lived under Egyptian rule for all this time. They have to go through a process where they learn to accept the Lord. They learn to have faith in God. They learn to recognize leaders within their community, spiritual and temporal leaders. And so this is the beginning of that process. And that's why I call this an object lesson, because they're faced with an immediate problem that they cannot solve. They go to the Lord, and the Lord provides an answer to them. Sometimes this seems to provide a more lasting faith than others. But then of course, after the water here, and this is not the first time, or the last time, I mean, that the Lord provides water for them in the wilderness. But then we also have the manna and the quail and some of these other miracles that that Martin wanted to discuss briefly.
Thank you. That great great introduction and background for the verses here. Chapter 16 is the next chapter, and the context here is that the Israelite community makes camp, and the people begin to complain, and then food is provided for them, and that comes in the form of manna and quail. And usually this whole idea of manna is skipped over, except in the context that God gave it to them. And so it seems very, very strange to us, and I guess so it should, because no one knows what it is. And as a matter of fact, in Hebrew, the word manna literally means "what is it," which is a great phrase. And if they didn't know what it was, how would we know? But some of the descriptions of it, I think, are worth noting here. It's described as small. And in appearance, a little bit like frost that you might see on plants when it's extremely cold. We read in our King James Version that it has the color and basic appearance of a coriander seed. And people generally skip over that as well and don't pause to think about what coriander is, but you've probably seen it in the supermarket fairly often. Coriander is the older word for cilantro. So, hey, if you like tacos and you get cilantro on it, and you see the seed, you've seeing coriander, and that's the description of what the manna looked like. It was white in appearance and very, very small. It was bakeable, boilable. They could use it in all kinds of different contexts. And we read in verse 31 that they called the food manna, and that's after, of course, this term, what in the world is it, or what is it? It tasted like thin white cakes made of honey. It was like small white seeds. It's quite an amazing description, and they ate it for the next 40 years. There are lots of different ideas about what it might have been, but no one has really come down to some consensus on that. The basic point is not so much the physical description of it, however, is that God provided for the people here. He gave them something that would sustain them. First of all, water, and then manna, and then quail. And as we hit chapter 17, which is next, we see that we have another incident where water is given them from a rock. Any thoughts here before we jump into chapter 17?
I have one thought on the measurements. So they said each person can gather a homer, and it's equal to a tenth of an ephah. And an ephah actually is interesting because it's an Egyptian measure. So an ephah is about 7.8 liters, and a homer is a tenth of that, so it's just under a liter per person.
Interesting.
Just to give an idea. So just about a quart of this stuff every day. And so just to give you an idea of how much material that is.
That's great. I've actually not known that.
Well, and it isn't just that they're eating it every day, right? They actually have to go through this effort every single day to gather it all and put it together. Except the day before the Sabbath, when they get double it, right? I mean, this is part of their routine for that 40 years. I imagine some of them got tired of it.
You know, and unless you're a little kid, you typically get tired and want some kind of a variety with what you're eating. But again,
well, I do get tired of it. It says it in the text.
Absolutely. This whole issue of the manna, it has several miraculous divine aspects to it. As Ben just pointed out, before the Sabbath day, you can gather extra for the next day, but you can't the other days of the week, or, you know, there are some pretty graphic descriptions of worms, and it goes rotten, but not for the Sabbath gathering when they gather twice as much for 2 days. It's something that for a faithful people, they would understand as a sign from God. And to me, one of the most fascinating parts of this sojourn in the desert is the transition, which ultimately never quite happens, between the mindset of a people who are in captivity to the mindset of a free people, and the mindset of people who are used to complaining, even though justifiably so, because of some of the difficulties they've been through, to a group of people who are essentially happy and thankful for all the blessings that they seem to have. Other thoughts before we jump into chapter 17?
Yeah, right at the end of chapter 16, and this goes back to the that covenant process that John pointed out earlier. Moses is given a special commandment, right? This is in 16 verse 32. And Moses said, "This is the thing which the Lord commandeth. Fill an omer of it to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread wherewith I have fed you in the wilderness, when I brought you forth from the land of Egypt." And Moses said unto Aaron, "Take a pot, and put an omer full of manna therein, and lay it up before the Lord to be kept for your generations." And so they take a container of this, right, a daily portion of it that's becomes one of their sacred relics. I think it's eventually kept in the ark. But this is a visual memory for them, for the people, of the things that the Lord is doing for them right now. It's not a small thing, and they're supposed to remember this as part of this process forever.
Any other points, John?
No, I think we can move on.
Okay. Great point. Thank you. Thank you for that, Ben. In chapter 17, the Israelite community leaves the desert, comes to a place that is called Rephidim, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and they complained about water, and ultimately here we have the first of a number of different times where in verse 3 it says, and I'll sort of give this the plain English statement, but the people were very thirsty and continued to complain to Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" This is one of a number of examples here of hyperbole. And if you read this and you're really serious and take absolutely every statement by Moses and by the people literally and don't understand that some of it's hyperbole, then I think in some ways you miss it. It isn't that the people necessarily expected to die. They were hoping not to. They were making a point about how bad and how desperate and how dire their situation was. And, of course, then we have this great imagery of the Lord telling Moses to take a stick, the same one that he struck the Nile with, and then strike a rock and water will come out of it. And then that happens, and they have water again. So this is a great story, and it's one that the actual place names, Massa and Meribah, in verse 7 of chapter 17, literally describe. Meribah, Massa and Meribah, the names mean testing and complaining, which is exactly what happened to the people. They were tested and they complained. And as Ben has mentioned before, this is a situation where the people's mettle is tested, and they have to grow. They have to grow from all of this. Ben, you were also going to mention here about this great event, which I'd like you to do if you have a minute, about Moses and the arms and the battle. This is a great event in this lesson.
So in Exodus 17, we're going to have a battle against Amalek. We assume that they brought their group of people to fight against Israel. So I'm going to start reading in verse 9 of chapter 17. "Moses said unto Joshua, choose out men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in mine hand. So Joshua did as Moses had said to him and fought with Amalek, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And it came to pass when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. And they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon. And Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, the one on the one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. and Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. We're not given a tremendous amount of information as to what caused this conflict. I think that in some ways this is another one of these object lessons, and this one is actually, I think, aimed more at Moses than anybody else. He's given this task of seeing that Israel will be successful, and he can't do it. He can't keep his arms raised, and so he needs the help of these other these assistants, right? He needs the help of Hur. He needs the help of
Aaron.
Aaron, yes. And this leads us into the chapter 18, where we suddenly have this idea where Moses figures out that he needs to delegate authority, that he cannot answer all the questions and deal with all the problems of this large community. He can't settle every dispute himself. So we have this kind of this object lesson where I think he learns that he has to have some assistance for them to be successful in as they move into their promised land. And of course, for Israel, right? Most of them are not engaged in the fight. But Moses is up there where they can see him, right? And they can see all this going on. And it actually makes a pretty dramatic scene, even in the text that we read. Thinking about Moses, and he's got his arms up, and then his arms go down, and suddenly they're losing and being chased backwards, and they get his arms back up and they're winning. I mean, you know, we've all seen perhaps dramatizations of this sort of thing, but it does create some very striking visual imagery.
It does. And John, before we have you talk a little bit about the incident with Jethro and Moses here, I wanted to make one comment also on the whole battle scene here with Moses' arms up and they win and down and they start to lose. This is just one in a whole series of extremely graphic visual images where if people do one thing or if one thing happens, God helps them prevail, and if they don't, then they do not prevail. And included in those would be the brass serpent, which helps people who are bitten by snakes healed. It's simple. You either do one thing or another. You look or you don't look on it. And that's fairly easy. This one would have hurt Moses' arms a bit to have them lifted up for such an extended period of time. But again, this is not such a difficult or a great thing, and it's graphic and the people can see it. And this seems to me to be part of a process where they're moving from a life of captivity and where they're told everything to one where they can hopefully learn a little bit about faith from very visual experiences in their life. And this is just one of a whole series of tests, and we can argue about how well it happened to turn out, but a great visual image and a great episode.
It is, and I half wonder, thinking of the image, just how the hands were raised, because in ancient Near Eastern imagery, if you raise your hand up like this is the standard pose for smiting people, and this is the way it's depicted in the iconography. And so you wonder if he had his hand up, like usually whoever's got their hand up like that has a club or a sword or something in it, but makes you wonder if that's when they talk about lifting up his hand, if that's the if there is a symbolic image there as well.
And after they're victorious, of course, then the Lord commands them to memorialize it again, just as with the manna, right? So Moses builds an altar. It ties it back into this process where we're building a history of things that God has done immediately for this group of people as they prepare to receive the Ten Commandments. So that
it's
their entire experience is not just the history in Genesis. They have immediate personal experience in what God can do.
And it's that keeping track of it, being able to remember the great things that God has done for you. And it's one of the reasons we're commanded to keep journals, and so that when we see things like this in our own lives, that we can record them and remember them in the future.
Other comments about chapter 18?
17.
Well, if we want to move to 18, we can do that. 18, you already mentioned, Ben, about this episode where Moses has to learn to delegate. And I find a couple of very interesting things about this. One of them I'm borrowing from Elder Maxwell, which is that, you know, Moses is the prophet. And somebody else comes up with this idea. And Moses is meek enough to listen to it, to listen to what people under him are saying and listen to their suggestions and not just think he has to come up with all the ideas himself or that he just has to listen to God and he doesn't need to listen to anybody else. So this is one of the great things about Moses here is that somebody comes along and says, well, why don't you do it this other way? And he listens. The other thing about that this brings up about delegating is when you delegate something, you never, or the people you delegate it to will never do it the way that you would do it. Sometimes they might do it much better, but they don't do it the way you do it, and you have to relinquish that some of that control and to let them take the task and do it their own way. And you can't sit there and say, no, you do it this way or you fix this and where you micromanage it to death. You have to, as he says it in verse 20 here, teach them the ordinances and laws and show them the way they must walk and the work they must do. And then you just let them do it. And that's always when you're in charge of something, that's always a scary thing to do is to let other people take over because they won't do it the way you do it, but they sometimes do it so much better than you would have.
This is also, excuse me, some verses in an episode that influenced Brigham Young very much is the residue of the saints were leaving Nauvoo after, excuse me, after Joseph Smith and Hiram were killed. Brigham Young took his cue from Exodus 18 here and organized the different groups according to hundreds and fifties and tens. And he saw how well this worked for Moses, and he was going to take a page out of the scriptures and use that for the trek westward. And it worked very well for Brigham Young as well. He was not involved in every single small little dispute resolution that could have otherwise occurred there as well. Other thoughts about chapter 18?
Just that the three criteria for choosing leaders, I think, are phenomenal for their compactness, right? You fear God, you're a man of truth, and you hate covetousness. I think that for a baseline, that's a pretty simple but valuable set of attributes for people that we would like to be telling us what we need to do.
It's a good point.
It is a good point. And that leaves us with chapters 19 and 20 before we jump to the second set of tablets in chapters 33 through 34. In 19 and 20, there's some amazing imagery about the Israelites at Mount Sinai, and there's some very specific laws and boundaries that are set starting in about verse 12 or so that might seem harsh, would even be an understatement to us. Yeah, it talks about marking a boundary and don't let people cross, and if an animal or a person goes beyond this boundary, they're put to death. And not only are they put to death, they're put to death in a certain way. They have to be stoned or shot with an arrow. Nobody touches them. I mean, it's very, very detailed. And the question comes up, well, why would that be? And it seems to me that the answer is so that the people will understand how important and how serious this is, that it's not to be taken lightly. And then, of course, when a trumpet is blown, then the people are to go up to the mountain. So the stage is set in a very specific way so that the people will take what is to happen after that very, very seriously, because there's not much that's more serious than the loss of life itself.
And this is not going to be that unusual to the Israelites. They come out of Egypt. We actually have exactly these same sorts of prescriptions at holy places in Egypt, where only certain people at certain times are allowed in there, and the penalty is death. And they're marked out with stones. And if you go out, if you wander into this area, and you're not authorized to do so, then you're put to death. So they would have seen this in Egypt, and so this would mark out the place as holy land.
Great information. Thank you. Other thoughts on chapter 19? Okay, let's move on to...
I do have one other thing.
Please, go ahead.
With chapter 19. Chapter 19 is a little bit unusual, because it's not, it sets up chapter 20, but it's not the way we think of it. So the whole Ten Commandments are given actually to the people by the voice of God. We think of Moses coming down with these Ten Commandments and so forth, and that's the popular image. But that's not what the text says. The text says that God himself speaks to the people. They're supposed to wash themselves, they're supposed to make themselves holy so they can listen to the voice of God. And then when it's over in chapter 20, they tell Moses, we don't want to listen to God. We're happy to have you talk to God and tell us what he said. And it was such a harrowing experience for them that they didn't want to go through it again.
That's a great point, and one that's often missed. People talk about the text of the Ten Commandments, but not how they were given. And you're right, in verse 1, it specifically talks about God spoke, and these were his words. And then he prefaces what he says by saying that he's the one that brought them out of Egypt. And then he goes through the list of the Ten Commandments. And these Ten Commandments are so important because they form the basis for Judeo-Christian society's morality and its laws, civil laws and criminal laws. They've just been incredibly valuable. This is not to say that this is the only significant laws of the past. The Code of Hammurabi and a number of others had great influence. There were laws in Rome that had great influence. But these are amazing laws, and they hit a broad variety of moral and criminal ideas that are so important, and yet this is so compact. If we had Jack Welch here to talk to us a little bit about these, he can probably, you know, expound for hours about how significant all these are and how short and simple they are. There was a great article that Dallin Oaks wrote several decades ago about the law and about how simple it ought to be, and how in the 1800s, during the time excuse me, of Brigham Young and Joseph Smith, you could put all of the laws of the United States on a bookshelf in a normal sized room quite easily, and how at the time that he was writing, you'd be lucky to get the laws of a county inside the same sized room, and if it would take a building to house all the laws of the United States, and how people had gone away from common sense to a series of detailed laws, and we were actually moving backwards more towards some of the specific and detailed laws that were what we should be trying to get away from. Jeremiah 31 talks about having the law in your inward parts and in your hearts, and God will be our God and will be his people. And that kind of an idea is encompassed in the Ten Commandments, not in the reams and reams and reams and reams of laws that we tend to find today. We try to micromanage things rather than look at the basic underlying ideas behind them.
And along with those lines, I'm glad you brought that up, Martin, because along those lines, the laws, in fact, the whole covenant, the whole Pentateuch, was supposed to be recited every year at a festival. And so they'd meet for the Feast of Tabernacles, and one of the things that they'd have to do is the king was supposed to recite the whole Pentateuch and all the laws there. In medieval Iceland, they had sort of the president of the country, who was called the Lögsögumaður. And he was supposed to recite a third of the laws every year at their festival from memory. And, you know, as silly as that may seem to us, it's really a nice serious point, because if you had to recite them all, then you could actually get it all in your inward parts, and you could know the whole law, and you could know whether you were keeping it or not. It's not like you know, today, where the laws are so long, so complex, that sometimes the people who are passing them don't even read them. But no one can keep up with all of the laws, and so to know whether your conduct is actually conforming to it or not, it's only when you've got it short and manageable, and you can keep it in mind, that you can actually keep it.
That is so true. You know, most people don't even realize all the laws that they violate. And you know, we read through the Old Testament and snicker a little bit about how many steps you could take on the Sabbath and all the...
That's not in the Old Testament, actually.
They're well said. The gist of it, the point that I'm making here, is that we sometimes seem to snicker a little bit about how about the detailed laws there, and yet if they could have seen into the future about all the laws that we have, they would be laughing back at us, because we have so many more laws than they could ever have thought of, by probably a factor of thousands or tens of thousands, that it's not even funny, which in a lot of ways is very sad. Well, should we move on to chapters 32 through 34? Any other thoughts about our...
Just one thought about that, and that is that the Israelites get these memorials to the things that God has done, right? And they also have a witness to the bad things that happen to them when they don't do what they're supposed to. This is the fear of God, so to speak, and I think that this is what gives their laws some real force in their society that maybe we don't have today. We replace values of God and righteousness with money, and that requires a much more detailed list of how you're going to manage it, you know, rather than the do what's good for your neighbor approach that that Israel is supposed to take.
Well said. Chapter 32. This is the famous experience where the people are waiting and waiting and waiting for Moses to come back down from the mountain. And to them, it seems like he's staying up on the mountain for a long, long time. And so then they ask Aaron if he will make them a god. And so he does. And he participates in all of this and suggests that they give to him their gold earrings and other pieces of gold, and then he takes them, and starting in verse 4 it talks about how he melts them down and pours them into a mold that he's created and makes a golden calf. And then an altar is built by Aaron in front of this golden calf, and obviously, there's great sin here, and the real question that comes up is, why would this have happened? What would really prompt this? I would be interested in your thoughts about why, after all of the events that they've been through, the Exodus itself, the miraculous way that they left, their miraculous salvation by the destruction of the Egyptians that followed them, the man of the quail, why would they turn to, in essence, idol worship again here with the golden calf? And I think the answer is here that they still have not overcome the background that they grew up into in Egypt. They still have the mindset that things have to be done for them, and if something unexpected happens, they are still not capable of dealing with it in an appropriate way, in a faithful way. I have a client who has done business with Russia for quite some time, and he makes similar kinds of comments about dealing with people who have grown up in a communist country where there were very, very strict rules and regulations, and things, maybe I can say it succinctly, decisions are made by such people who have grown up in a society like that that are difficult for people who have grown up with more freedom to understand. And so I think that's the explanation here. The people.
Thoughts adding to that. One of them is that if you look at ancient letters, if somebody goes away on a trip, you didn't know that they were ever going to come back. We take going off on a trip as that, of course, you're going to come back. It's the exception where you don't. Where their death is could happen to somebody very easily, and you wouldn't know about it. The other thing is that, of course, that golden calves would be par for the course in Egypt. You could also have golden crocodiles and other things. But this idea that they're going to get a golden calf, excuse me, is just typical from where they what they've come out of. You know, sometimes when we see converts in the church, they bring some of their old ideas back to them. Sometimes it takes a while for those ideas to work their way out.
Well, and interestingly enough, I mean, sometimes I think we give this more of a bad rap than it deserves, because they're not trying to worship a different god. They're creating an idol of the god that's led them out of Egypt. They're showing initiative, really, for the first time as a people, right? It just happens to be misguided. There is an attempt to learn, and we have another object lesson here, and of course the results are quite terrifying to the Israelites. But I think that this is still part of that growing experience, and it's not an entirely bad. I mean, perhaps Moses has been left up on the mountain all this time by the Lord, waiting for this event to happen, right? Because the Lord then says to Moses, it's time to get down to the people because they're doing something they shouldn't.
But he also tests Moses here too. So look in verse 10 of 32, where God says, my wrath may wax hot against them, I may consume them, and I will make of thee a great nation. And Moses, you know, says, well, we'll forget all your kinfolk and just go with you and your posterity. And Moses has a chance to say, I don't want that, and to go to bat for the children of Israel. Proves himself.
Well said. Other comments about the beginning of chapter 32 here? I have one thought about verse 14, which is quite interesting to me. It talks about the Lord repenting of a decision that he has previously decided, or as you would read if you were to open the contemporary English version or today's English version, it would say God changed his mind and didn't bring on the people the disease that he had threatened. And for some people, this is a little bit troubling. If God is all-knowing, how would he be changing his mind? What does this really mean? This, to me, is a representation of the idea of a contingency being met. It's not so much that God has changed his mind in the sense that he's fickle. It's a description that his mind has changed about what he is going to do because of the acts of the people.
There's a translation problem here.
Oh, well, go ahead. You would know the translation issues, please.
The Hebrew has vayinahem, and so it's from this root naham is to feel sorry, and you know we think of that in the Book of Mormon where they've got Nahum. Is where they're sorrowing. It may be a different root, but that's the base idea. Whereas repenting is usually off the verb shuv, which is to turn around, to return to something. And the Septuagint takes it one step further as heliosathe kurios peritaes tachias. So it's the Lord was propitiated or atoned concerning the evil which he said he would do to the people. So both of those ancient versions take a little different point of view from the King James, where the King James has repent, and the others don't have it so much as this isn't God changing his mind or anything. This is he feels sorry or he is satisfied concerning with Moses's and the others' efforts.
I would let me make one point, and then I'll turn it over to you, Ben. And that's exactly the point that I was, was making from a legal context, and that is that a contingency had been met. What was it? The people had atoned appropriately or done what needed to be done so that they were not going to have the disaster that had been threatened. The requirement had been met. This is not a fickle God. This is a requirement being met so that a result has been changed. Go ahead, Ben.
The word that that John mentioned, Nahum, is most familiar, I think, to us from the story of Noah, right, where it gets used repeatedly.
Yeah.
To talk about God's state of mind. And it isn't just a single meaning. It has an entire range of emotional differences. It can be on the one end vengeful and angry, and on the other end it can be kind of the comforting you do for somebody who needs comfort. And so in some of these stories, in particular the one with Noah, right, God starts off as angry at the people. When everything is said and done, Noah's actions have made God not angry, right? He is more in tune with the emotional state of his people and more supportive of them. Even though at the end of the Noah story, we all know that evil hasn't been done away with, and they're still struggling. And in some ways, I think that that line here in this story is meant for us to draw a bit of a connection between Moses and what Moses is doing for the people and Noah. And what happens with Noah, it's a reminder connecting what's about to happen and what is happening there at Sinai with the same process of renewal that occurred with the flood and with Noah.
We have not too many minutes left. Let's talk about, in the time that we have left, this set of stone tablets. In chapter 34, it talks about Moses being told by God to cut two stone tablets like the first ones, and then God will write on them and get ready for the next day. And then it talks about Moses actually doing that, cutting the tablets, and early the next morning he carried them up to Mount Sinai just as the Lord had commanded. John, I'd be interested in your ideas on this. How does this reconcile, or can it be reconciled, with the statement that was made earlier about the first set of Ten Commandments being something that God had orally given the people? Were they spoken first and then written down after? How do we take a look at this? Some people may be asking that question.
Well, if you look at the entirety of the law code, the Ten Commandments are given orally. And then there are a number of other laws that are given, and they take up a couple more books. Think of Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy are all part of these law codes. For the Jews, it's the Torah, the law. And there are more to the laws than just the Ten Commandments. They can be summed up in the Ten Commandments for the most part, but they're elaborated and some specific details are given. What I was thinking of is these tablets is, of course, throughout the ancient Near East from the Law Code of Hammurabi, which is carved on this large stone stela, a round one to numerous ones in Egypt where they will put royal decrees on a tablet of stone. It's, and they range from, say 4 inches thick and about, a foot or a foot and a half wide and 2 feet tall. Some of them are smaller than that, to ones that are taller than people, like the Law Code of Hammurabi. So all of putting this on there is standard cultural norm. You would think if they're going to have to haul it around, they're going to keep it small. But
Not so easy all around the Rosetta Stone where you go, for example.
Well, yeah, well, the Rosetta Stone is an example of that, where it's a royal decree and it's set up on a stone tablet, and this is a divine decree. And you put them on stone tablets and you set them up so that people could read them. And there are a number of cases where these are set up in temples or in the area where Israel will settle, they'll even plaster walls and write the text on the walls.
And it's part of this whole idea of memory, right?
Yeah.
It's there not just to give them the law, but it's there to commemorate these events through which they receive the law.
And the covenant that they're making. So these are agreements that they're going to keep these particular laws because of the things that God has done for them.
We often think of this as being just a recitation of the Ten Commandments, but if you take a look at verse 18, for example, it tells them to keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread again, and it goes through some other requirements and laws that are in addition to the Ten Commandments. So this is a bit more detailed than just the Ten Commandments, and it's to serve as a little bit broader of a legal base than just those ten statutes would otherwise do. We're about out of time, gentlemen. Other thoughts before we wrap things up?
No,
just that the second time up there, when he's up there doing the tablets, it says he spent 40 days and didn't eat or drink while he was doing it, right? This isn't meant to be just a simple short list. This is a significant endeavor on his part, and he spends a significant amount of time writing this down, and I think that that there's some significant imagery there, too. I think that's...
Well, that imagery, is you pointed out, is actually taken up in the Gospels, because Jesus goes fast for 40 days and then comes and gives the Sermon on the Mount.
Well said. And with that, let me thank everyone who has participated, John Gee and Ben McGuire. And thank you all for listening and joining our roundtables. We hope you will watch others and take a look at some of the other publications and things that are on the Interpreter website. And with that, we will sign off from Lesson 14.